Well, hey, go ahead and grab a seat. Let's give it up one more time for Ashley and the Cross Point Band. Well, hey, my name is Chris, one of the pastors here at Cross Point, and it's so great to have you joining us. We're in part two of this series that it's called Parenting in the 21st Century, and this series is really for everybody. We're talking to parents, coaches, leaders, grandparents, aunts, uncles, those who want to be parents someday, and this is really for anyone who feels the responsibility of equipping the next generation, of equipping infants and toddlers and preschoolers all the way up through high school and beyond. And so this series is for every single one of you. And last week, Kurt actually kicked us off with this series by helping us walk through the four phases of parenting, And just a quick refresher, if you didn't catch those, I'll let you know that right now I'm in phase number two. I'm in this second phase, and this journey of parenting, you kind of toggle back and forth between these phases. And I can tell you that for my wife, Hannah, and I, we are in the king and queen phase. We're in the king and queen phase. I've got an 18-month-old daughter at home, and I'm pretty sure within the last, two or three months, her favorite word is, and all the parents in the room can agree with me, no, right? I mean, if you're joining us at home, say it out loud, no, right? I mean, you've heard this before. If you're a parent, if you're a grandparent, aunt, uncle, I mean, you've heard this, and we're right in the midst of it. And so I can tell you, we are right there in that king and queen phase. And I know we'll toggle back and forth. We'll go other places. But right now, man, we're in the thick of it. We are right there. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, there's actually this really cool clip from this movie, Instant Family. If you don't know the movie, it's a hilarious one that gives you just a taste of what the king and queen phase looks like. Check this out.
Okay, tuck in, everybody.
Where's my potato chips?
Oh, we're not having chips tonight, Munchkin. Sorry.
I want my chips.
Let's try some of this meatloaf, okay?
No! Hey, I want my chips!
I'm not having chips!
You sure you don't want to just give her some chips?
No, we're not giving her chips.
Lita, stop right there.
Oh, my God.
Relax. Okay. Hey, watch your feet, okay?
Hey, you give those to me. Give me
calm down. Don't cry. I'll get it. Chip. Just stay there, Mom. Right here. God!
Oh my God, you okay?
God, what up?
You okay?
Oh. Lita, stop!
Stop! What are you doing?
What? I'm trying to put it out!
With ketchup?
Put it out!
Stop it!
Alright.
Lita?
Wait, what's that noise? Why is she growling? That wasn't in the classes, I got nothing for that. She's got a knife?
It's just a SpongeBob.
It's still a knife.
Now, it's not quite like that yet at our house, and hopefully it never gets there, but you know what I'm saying, right? I mean, the king and queen phase, no, you hear that, you hear the scream, you hear that lately, you know, her favorite thing is to look at you while she's got her food, stare you right in the eyes, and drop it off, and just wait for your reaction. I mean, we're right in the middle of it, and so I know what you're probably thinking. You're thinking, Chris, you've got an 18-month-old daughter. Are you really about to stand up there and give me advice on parenting? And the answer is, yeah, I am. I really am. And here's the thing. Before you start to check out on me, and I get it. If you're there, I get it. I mean, I understand. But before you do that, I want to encourage you to lean in. Because at times in my past, as I've thought about parenting, as I've watched parenting, I've kind of felt like an NFL insider. You guys know these people, NFL insiders? You know, they're the ones that know who's going to get drafted before the draft even happens. I mean, these are the guys that they kind of know. They've got the insider knowledge. Because for me, I had something that most of you don't have. I have years of experience of working with teenagers, working with 5th through 12th grade students. You know, I've watched families from the outside for years, and I've gotten firsthand experience of watching great parenting, and I've got firsthand experience of watching some we'll say, less than stellar parenting. You know, I've once heard it said that parenting, you know, the days are long, but the years, they're so short. Right? I mean, parents in the room, grandparents in the room, you can agree with that, right? The years, they're so short. I mean, on the front end, you feel like you're just doing whatever you can to survive. You're just getting to bedtime, whatever, getting to bath time, whatever it might be. You're just trying to get there. And then you blink and they're 10 and they're 18 and they're graduating and they're getting in the car to drive off to college. And you're immediately running through your mind thinking, did I prepare them? Did I tell them everything that they needed to know? Are they ready to enter into the real world? And And honestly, the answer's no. I mean, they're not. You missed something. You forgot something. And it's understandable. I'll forget something. We'll forget something because you were busy being a parent. You were busy. You had things to do. You had classes to get to, baseball practice to get to. I mean, you were busy. You probably forgot a few of those essential things. But what's, again, it's understandable. But it's kind of like that moment when you first left the hospital. Parents in the room, parents watching online, grandparents, aunts, uncles. Maybe you've experienced this. Maybe you've watched this before. It's kind of a combination of excitement and terror at the same time. Do you remember this? Excitement and terror. It just happened just not too long ago for us. We were at Community North, and my wife, Hannah, she delivered on a Friday. And they told us, they said, you know, you guys are going to get discharged on Sunday morning, which is great. You'll have plenty of time to relax, you know. But just make sure, you've got to be out of here by noon. You've got to be out of here by noon. And so we did what any good parent would have done. We left at 11:59 a.m., right? Like, we stayed as long as possible because there were professionals there. There were experts there. There were people that if we didn't know what to do, we could say, help, do this. We need your help. We don't know what to do. And then they walk you down. They walk you down to the front. They strap your baby in the car. And then they close the door. Do you remember this? They close the door. And they just kind of wave at you. And they've got this knowing look in their eyes because they know that you are terrified. They know that you feel completely unprepared. That's exactly how we felt. It was this moment of being terrified, feeling unprepared, but excited at the same time. And I remember thinking, like, you're coming home with us, right? Like, you're going to get into the back seat and you're just going to come and, like, kind of help us through this. But you know, they didn't. And they didn't for you either. But as time went on, you figured it out, right? I mean, with help, you figured it out. And it was in that moment, it was in that phase that it kind of dawned on me that just because I have a parent doesn't mean I know anything about being one. Or maybe even a little bit better. Just because I was a kid, it doesn't mean I know anything about raising one. And so you remember this, you know, sitting in the car, ready to go home, feeling terrified and excited at the same time, but knowing that you will figure it out. But my wife Hannah and I, we were like sponges. I'm sure like many of you were. We were sponges for good parenting advice, whether it came from a book or from a video or from maybe an expert or from friends or family or whoever it might be. We were just sponges, just trying to soak up as much advice and experience as we could. Because just a few months before, like I said, I was a student pastor. I spent so much time with teenagers. I saw teenagers that were well-equipped for their future. I saw families that were struggling in those moments. I saw parents that were struggling with what to do next. And so I had all these interactions. And we saw these great examples of what it meant to be a great parent. And when we saw those examples, when I saw those examples of great parents, I wasn't afraid to call it out. I wasn't afraid to ask, hey, what are you doing? How did you get to this point? How did you get from the car seat to the driver's seat with the relationship still intact? How did you do it? Because the relationship is the important part. The relationship is one that so often just gets lost in the shuffle of all the busyness, of all the things that you're trying to accomplish and do and set them up and teach them. And sometimes you undermine that relationship. And so when I saw it done well, I wasn't afraid to ask. How did you do this? There were parents at the church. There were parents in the community. There were parents in our neighborhood that I would literally sit down. I'd take out to dinner. My wife, Hannah, and I, we would take out to dinner, ask them, how did you do it? And oftentimes the answer was pretty well the same. We don't know. We just kind of loved our kids. But we knew better. We knew better. We knew there was a game plan. We knew there was an approach. They had habits. And for them, it was just intuitive, and oftentimes they couldn't verbalize it, but my wife Hannah and I, we were students, and we were serious about figuring this out because we wanted to get it right. And here's what we noticed, a few things right up front. We noticed that the parents that seemed to have been able to maintain this strong relationship with their kids, you know, through those middle school and high school years, those parents, a lot of times, they had fewer rules. They had fewer rules than the kids who were always breaking the rules and getting in trouble. You know, one of the things that we noticed in our middle school and high school years with students is that the kids that were always getting in trouble, always getting grounded, they had so many more rules. And in our experience, these kids, they never really got better. I mean, they were always the ones getting in trouble. But when I would sit down with these parents that I saw doing it so well, that had such great relationships, I would ask them about that. They said, oh, you know, we don't really have a ton of rules. There's not really a ton that goes into it. And then last week when we were talking about this nurtured heart approach, it clicked. I realized that their approach was very similar to this. Check out this nurtured heart approach if you need a reminder. First stand, absolute no. I mean, there were some things that they just absolutely refused to energize. This negativity, this I'm going to pick up the food, I'm going to stare you in the face, and I'm going to drop it off. I mean, my daughter and I have had some moments. I mean, she's gotten the better of me sometimes, and I've gotten the better of her sometimes. I mean, this absolute no, I'm not going to energize it. Second one that I saw when I talked to these parents is this absolute yes. They were always ready to support, to encourage, to coach, to equip those successes. And then the last one was this absolute clarity. I mean, these families, these kids, these students, they knew the boundaries. It wasn't up in the air. And we're going to be talking about discipline and things like this more in the coming weeks. This is just kind of just a beginning note on this. But these parents, they did an incredible job of utilizing this nurtured heart approach. And the other thing that I noticed in these parents is that they had some few like key characteristics that really across the board of the 5, 6, 7 parents that I was thinking of this week as I was prepping, you know, they all had these same key characteristics. The first one is this, and it sounds kind of odd, right? They weren't afraid of their children. And if you don't have kids, you might hear that and think, well, that seems kind of odd. Why would you be afraid? But so often I saw this in the families that struggled, that had these difficulties relationally, the parents and the kids, there was just this disconnect. And oftentimes when they were afraid of their children, they were really fearing the rejection of their children. And the parents that did it really well, they didn't fear rejection from their children. Because when this rejection would happen, if they were afraid of their kids, the kids became in charge of that relationship. They became in charge of that marriage oftentimes. But these unique parents, they didn't fear rejection from their children. And another thing that I noticed in these parents is that they resisted this temptation to involve their kids in everything. Not only were they not afraid of their kids, but they weren't afraid of their kids missing out on something. In other words, here's how I would say it, that they prioritized relationships over experience. They prioritized these experiences that they could experience together rather than the experiences that would send everybody off in 100 different directions every single week. And then there was this other thing. This other thing that I saw in, you know, Kim and Kevin and Mike and Trina and Craig and Kelly and all these great parents that I watched for years. And it's what we're going to spend the rest of our time discussing today. And as we got to know these families through the years, you know, these multiple years of watching them, we noticed that all of them had what I would consider a healthy marriage. Not perfect, but healthy. In fact, we would walk away from these conversations with parents. You know, I would sit down. I spent an hour sitting with this you know, group of parents and just asking them questions. And perhaps what I realized the best gift was that I could give to my future children was to have a healthy marriage with my wife. You know, these were the parents who still liked each other. These are the parents who still went out on dates. These are the parents that went on vacation without their kids. These are the parents that prioritized that relationship first. And they encouraged it in my wife and I. I mean, we were newly married. We were trying to be sponges and learn everything we could. And they encouraged us. Guys, don't forget about your relationship. Prioritize your marriage. Last week we talked about it, that you as the parents are the MVP in this. It's not your kids. It's you. So prioritize that relationship. And I'm sure, you know, some of you are thinking, Chris, you know, I thought we were in a parenting series. Like, why are we talking about marriage? But here's what you need to know. Your family doesn't start when you add children to the picture. Your family started years before, long before, and kids are just a welcomed addition to the family. Remember from last week, you are the MVP. Your relationship is the MVP. Your relationship, it deserves the priority. And for some of you, you know, that's when you're going to put the pen down. That's when you're going to turn off the stream. That's when you're going to stop taking notes. And I understand that because this might come across as discouraging news to you because it feels just so out of reach. Maybe it's discouraging for some of you because, you know, you just feel like there's no way that I'll ever be able to reach that. And honestly, I was a little tempted. We were a little tempted to just not even talk about this, you know, because it's a lot easier to just talk about parenting, just jump right into the tips and the tools of the trade and all these things you can get to. But it really begins right here with this healthy marriage. And here's what we're going to talk about for the next few minutes. You see, to isolate parenting from marriage is actually stealing something really valuable from the current and from the next generation. To do so, to remove it, it's not only just removing the bullseye, but it's removing the entire target as a whole. And I know this brings us to this uncomfortable tension that I'm sure you're already feeling. This tension between what's real and what's ideal. This tension between what's real, you know, real life, the things that, you actually walk through versus the picture perfect, you know, magazine cover family. The tension between what's real and what's ideal. And it's an uncomfortable tension because, you know, for so many of us, it might feel like ideal is just, it's out of reach. It's not going to happen. And again, it's easy to do this when we talk about something like marriage, but to ignore reality, it leaves us or it leaves me teaching in such a way that it doesn't take into consideration the families and the family dynamics that people are actually walking through. It leaves this impression, if we don't deal with what's real, that the message of Jesus has no bearing on real life. To ignore current reality, it leaves us with this static kind of stained glass religion that is completely removed from reality. And what we do right here in a church becomes nothing more than a reminder of somebody else's reality that I will never attain to. And so for our discussion on parenting to be relevant, we have to take into account what's real, which for Christians, for Jesus followers, if you consider yourself a follower of Jesus, this should be really easy. And it might come to you as a shock as to why I say that, because quite honestly, when we have a discussion on parenting, a relevant discussion about real life family dynamics and family dysfunction, it should come easy because the Bible should be your perfect example of what not to do. You see, the Bible has, really in the Old Testament, has virtually no examples of what good family, good parenting looks like. You see, when we look at the Bible, when we look at these illustrations, it's really of real-world family dysfunction. It should be your go-to source. I mean, just think about it for a second. The first family, we look at Adam and Eve. You know, these were the ones that from the very beginning, they're pretty much a disaster. I mean, think about it. Sin entered the world. If you're a Jesus follower, sin entered the world through Adam and Eve, even before they had kids. And then they immediately started blaming each other and their kids. And we don't know a ton about their kids, but we do know that one of the brothers killed the other. I mean, that's the first family. That's the first few pages, right? I mean, the Old Testament is filled with family dysfunction. And so the point being is this. The church should be really good at taking into account the realities of family life. Taking into consideration what's actually going on in any conversation about parenting, because the Bible is full of bad examples. But at the same time, the authors of the New Testament, they paint this picture of what could be and what should be as it relates to family. They actually point us to the ideal while they still embrace the reality of what's actually happening. They point us to the ideal, and we shouldn't be surprised because they knew what we intuitively know. And it's simply this, that if we remove ideal from the conversation, if we completely remove it because it's maybe simply out of reach for some, it just ensures that it will remain out of reach for everyone, for the next generation. And part of our responsibility as parents, as grandparents, aunts, uncles, future parents, is to give our kids and our grandkids something to aim for, giving them a target to shoot after. And when it came to teaching and living, you know, in the middle of this tension, Jesus was the master. I mean, he was the master at doing so. He was right there in the middle between reality and ideal. And he clung to this tension. He didn't abandon it. But then Of course, he did abandon it eventually because the gospel doesn't begin with once upon a time in a world full of flowers and rainbows. No. That's not how it works. The gospel, Christianity, begins like this, that Christ, he died for our sins. The gospel, it assumes sin. It assumes real while pointing to ideal. That Jesus, he showed up in this perfectly disordered world where ideal, it seemed out of reach, honestly, for everyone. The gospel, it begins with, for God so loved the world. And you might ask, Chris, which world? Like the Adam and Eve pre-sin world or our world? It's our world. Right here, our broken, our less than perfect, our less than ideal world. And the tension between real and ideal, it was found within, you know, just about every single one of Jesus' parables. You know, these made-up stories that Jesus would use to teach and to get to a point, that the real and ideal is found just between about every single one of these. You know, Jesus would say things like this, you know, the kingdom of God is like, and his disciples would be like, Jesus, that's great, but this isn't the kingdom of God. To which he would say, yeah, come to me, all who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest. And then he would pivot once again, and he would point to the ideal. And he would say things like, you've heard it said not to commit adultery. And they're like, yeah, we've heard that, Jesus. And Jesus is like, okay, great. But I tell you, any man who even looks at a woman with lust has already committed adultery in his heart. To which I'm sure his audience would say, well, Jesus, that takes it a little further. Like, Jesus, that makes it a little bit harder for all the rest of us. That kind of makes us feel a little bit bad about ourselves. So why don't you just don't say things like that anymore? Jesus, that's just, it's unrealistic. But he kept saying things like that, consistently pointing people to the ideal while living in the reality of it. But he gave people something to aspire to. And then he would bump into people who had fallen short. And when he did this, he didn't do what religious leaders of his current day would do. He didn't condemn these people when he bumped into them. No, he actually condemned the condemners, and then he went and he died for those that they condemned. You see, instead of lowering the standard, Jesus turned up the grace. When religious leaders, when they attempted to trap him, when they tried to trap him in his own words on a discussion on marriage, Jesus, he raised the standard so high. He raised the bar so high to the ideal that when he finished talking about marriage and when he finished talking about divorce, his apostles, the 12 that followed him everywhere, that kind of knew the reality of life, that had walked with Jesus and seen the miracles and heard the stories, they're like, Jesus, if this is a situation between a husband and wife, it's better to not marry. In other words, Jesus, you made it sound so permanent. And honestly, Jesus, that's just unrealistic. I mean, things happen, people change. To which Jesus would have said, yeah, I know, that's why I'm here. And this is the tension. This is the beauty of the gospel. This is why if you've walked away from faith, perhaps you should reconsider. You see, Jesus never dumbed down the truth, but he also never turned down the grace. And here's the fascinating thing. John was one of the four authorized biographers of Jesus' life. You know, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. John was a guy who had walked with Jesus, you know, seen him do miracles and heard him talk, you know, 3.5 years with Jesus, you know, seeing Jesus interact with people on a daily basis, having real conversations with people. He saw Jesus dealing with the reality while pointing to the ideal on a daily basis. And John, he said, it was remarkable. Day in, day out, Jesus, he would point these people who are living with real life difficulties, he would point them to the ideal. He consistently pointed them to the ideal while helping them navigate what they were living through. And when John was an old man, kind of looking back over his life, looking back over his time with Jesus, he kind of summarizes it with these incredibly powerful words. He says this, The word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. It literally like camped out among us. He didn't send us more rules. He didn't give us a bunch of regulations we needed to follow. No, he became one of us. He navigated our reality. He showed us in human form. He showed up. He moved in. And then he says this. He says, and we have seen We have seen his glory. And then this next phrase summarizes the type of Jesus follower I really hope to become someday. The type of person I want to be. This next phrase, you know, in fact, if you've lost your faith, perhaps it's because nobody ever explained this part about Jesus' character to you. Check this out. The glory of the one and only Son who came from the Father, full of grace and full of truth. He was a full dose of grace and a full dose of truth. Again, he didn't dumb down the truth to make us feel better about ourselves, but he never turned down the grace. And again, that's the kind of person I hope to become. John, he wraps up this passage again with this thought, and there's so much that could be unpacked here. But he says this, he says, for the law, talking about, you know, the law, the Jewish law, he says, for the law was given by Moses, but grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. You see, it was Jesus who first introduced this tension between grace and truth. And he lived right in the middle of it. And here's the thing. As inviting as this is a difficult thing to live out. And yet, it's what we've been called to do if you call yourself a Christian, if you call yourself a Jesus follower. I mean, come on, our role as the body of Christ is, it's our responsibility. This is our role in culture. This is how we serve as comfort and conscience in our community. I mean, you know what the conscience does, right? Your conscience? You know, from time to time, it makes us feel a little bad about ourselves, kind of brings about the reality of what's going on. But a properly informed conscience is also what keeps us from losing our way. It keeps us from losing our bearings. Our conscience tells us when we're starting to veer into dangerous territory. And it reminds us that we're about to undermine our future and maybe the future of those that are following behind us. And so every once in a while, we need to be reminded. We need to be reminded of what should be and what could be. Maybe not what can be for us, but what could be for our children, our grandchildren, future generations. Every once in a while, we all need to be coaxed back into this tension between what's real and what's ideal. And so when it comes to parenting, marriage matters. And any attempt to downplay the importance of marriage, to downplay its role, it's just misguided. Not because of the dynamic it creates within a family, but because it robs children of an opportunity to aspire for the ideal. And so how do we do this? I want you to go ahead and grab your phone, jump over to the connection card. I've got a few next steps that I want you to look at. You know, I want you to think about, you know, maybe ask yourself this question this week. And let's be honest, none of us fully live the ideal. I mean, it's just not true. None of us fully live the ideal. We all fall short. And so in the midst of my real, how can I continue to lift up the ideal? I want you to ask yourself that question this week. What does this mean for me in my context, in my role as parent, as grandparent, as single parent, as aunt, as uncle, as future parent? What does this mean for me in my role? In the midst of my real, how can I lift out the ideal? And this is not about feeling bad or shameful or less than because of my real, because of my reality. No. It's about being honest about the real. Because that's what Jesus does. He meets us in the midst of the real. He meets us there, but he still calls us to more. So reflect on that question. That's the first next step. Second next step, kids' environments opening this weekend. You know, I'm so excited about this. You know, like I said, I've got an 18-month-old daughter. She's going to be here this weekend. I'm so excited for her to be in a kids' environment. I mean, it's going to be so great for her. I'm sure she doesn't even really know what it means to, like, play with other kids. And maybe an 18-month-old doesn't really know how to do that, I guess. But we'll find out. But if you'd like to be a part of investing in young lives, maybe join a volunteer team. Let us know. Mark that on your connection card. We'd love for you to be a part of one of those teams. And the third thing. I hope you'll be back next weekend. We'll be in part three of this series, both in person and online. Part three of this series, Parenting in the 21st Century. And for those of you maybe tuning in online, maybe it's just adding your email. Maybe it's just saying you want to stay connected. Maybe it's liking us on Facebook or subscribing to our YouTube channel so you can stay up to date on all the content. And again, now as I close, I just want to tell you one more reason why, for me, this has become so important. You see, the summer after my freshman year of college and my sophomore year of college, I spent time interning at a church as a student ministry intern. I've spent years hanging out with teenagers and watching parents parent. And I spent a summer with this husband and wife named Kim and Kevin. And Kim was the youth pastor of this church, and she's an incredible leader, incredible coach and teacher. And so I spent some time working under Kim that summer. And they welcomed me into their family. I mean, I got to be a part of their real lives. I got to see what this family looked like on a day-to-day basis. And honestly, you know, they're one of those families, one of those parents that I talked about earlier that showed me what great parents look like. That showed, you know, my girlfriend at the time, Hannah, what great parents can look like. And that first summer, I spent a lot of time with her son. He was in eighth grade. His name was Jackson. And Jackson had this friend that showed up pretty early on in the summer. His name was Kyle. And Kyle, he was just kind of there all the time. I mean, you guys know these kind of kids. I mean, they just kind of show up, and then they're always there. They never go anywhere, and they're just always ready to hang out, always ready to be there and just be a part of what's ever happening. And so I spent a ton of time with Kyle that summer. Got to know him pretty well, and what I came to learn about Kyle is that he didn't really have much of a home life. Kind of lived between his grandmother and his father and kind of back and forth, but for the most part, he kind of made his own decisions, kind of was on his own. You know, he's one of those kids that didn't really need to call and let anyone know he was going anywhere. He just kind of did whatever he wanted. And Kyle let us know at the end of that summer that he was going to have to move to New York because his dad was leaving. And Kyle didn't want to go. I mean, the south side of the city was the only place he'd ever known. It was the only place that he'd ever really connected with other people. He'd moved a ton of times in his life. And so Kim and Kevin, they offered for him to stay for the school year. They offered for him to stay with them just for that school year. And after some conversations with his grandmother and his father, they relented and said, yeah, okay, that's fine. But here's the thing. His sister's got to stay with him too. You see, we didn't know he had a sister. Had no idea. But Kim and Kevin, being the people that they are, the incredible, incredible people that they are, they opened their home to both of them. And that was 10 years ago. And today, Kyle is a graduate from IUPUI. His sister is on her way to graduating from Ball State. And what I think Kim and Kevin gave them, more than anything, was a picture of what could be. You know, I can't tell you how many times that summer I heard Kyle say, man, I've never done this before. And it was sitting around a dinner table with a family eating a meal together. I've never been on a trip before. I've never left this state on a vacation before. What is this like? You see, what they gave to Kyle and to his sister was a picture of what a family looks like. They gave them meals at a table. They gave them family game nights. They gave them vacations, hard conversations, opportunities to ask for forgiveness, and how to learn to forgive. What they did is they showed them what a family is and what they could aspire towards. You know, as you know, there are tens of thousands of children that won't aim for the ideal because they don't even know it's there. They don't even know that exists. They've never even seen it before. They've never experienced it. And Kyle and Michaela were just like them. But then someone showed them. And here's really the point of this. We're still going after the ideal. To do anything that removes the ideal from the equation, the conversation, to downplay the importance of parents raising their kids together simply because it seems too ideal, too American, too traditional, too Western. It's stealing from the next generation. It's stealing the future from our future generations. And so, yeah, it was tempting to just jump past this. It would have been a lot easier. It would have been a lot safer. There would certainly been a lot less opportunities to be misunderstood. But that would have been irresponsible because parenting is first and foremost about preparing our children for the future, which requires us to cast a compelling vision of what could be. Academically, financially, spiritually, and especially relationally. And our shortcomings as parents, they can serve as a catalyst for our children as they climb higher than we could ever imagine they would. And it's a win for them, it's a win for us, it's a win for our community as a whole. So let's still instill this dream in their hearts, in their minds, of what could be. Let's give them something to aspire towards. And let's resist the voices in our culture that have the potential to steal the dream of family from them. There will always be this tension between what's real and what's ideal. So when it comes to family, let's not resolve that tension. Let's live in it. Let's parent in it. Let's follow Jesus through it. After all, he came and he made his dwelling among us. And he was full of grace. And he was full of truth. Would you stand with me? I want to pray for you, and then we're going to wrap this up and get you out of here. God, thank you. Thank you for coming and making your dwelling among us, God. Thank you for showing up, for showing us that it's capable to live in the middle, to live in the middle, to live in the tension between what's real and what's ideal. Jesus, I ask for every single person in this room, every single person within the sound of my voice right now, God, to be encouraged, to be challenged, to be equipped, God, to know that they are capable of doing it, to be capable of following after you as they live in the tension of what's both ideal, but also what's real. God, I ask that for every single one of us, God, that we would have an opportunity this week to strive for the ideal.